from Aspen Public Radio. This is Curated, stories on the artists who visit and live in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock, arts and culture reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. It is Monday, October 9th. In 1917, artist Marcel Duchamp submitted what he considered a piece of art to the Society of Independent Artists. The piece of work was called Fountain, and it was a porcelain urinal. But that event led to art critics really having to dig into what makes art art and what makes art good or bad. Today's episode is a broadcast of Aspen Art Museum's recent Great Debate, a forum where presenters confronted one of the most fundamental questions of contemporary art today. Is there such a thing as bad art? You'll be hearing from Aspen Institute curator Lisa Bollinger
and Colorado Mountain College's Robert Martin,
who will be arguing for the proposition, while artist Teresa Booth Brown and Adam Lerner, director of the Museum of Contemporary Art Denver, will make cases against it. The debate played out using the Oxford Union style and was moderated by Aspen Public Radio News Director Carolyn Zachariasen. Thanks for tuning in. First, we'll hear from Lisa Bollinger of the Aspen Institute.
There is bad art. It's actually a very simple argument. Very few would argue with the assertion that there is good art. And there is actually great consensus on what good art is. So if there is such a thing as good art, then inextricably we acknowledge that there is bad art. I have no doubt that every person in this room has walked into a gallery, a restaurant, someone's home, maybe even a museum, and whispered, wow, that's bad art. But few of us actually take the time to consider what we mean by this declaration. Where this assertion gets muddy is when we then try to find a universally accepted definition of bad art. There is no single definition that is absolute and immutable. The determination of bad art is entirely personal and subjective. It is dependent on the consumer or viewer of the work and their particular life experience, education, preferences, exposure to art, and many other factors, including the context in which the art is viewed. The definition of good or bad art should not be confused with popular opinion or with market forces. Just because the populace decides or determines that something is good or bad does not necessarily make it true. Please remember that almost all new art is condemned as bad when it is first presented. It is only after time that it is reconsidered and discovered to be innovative and groundbreaking. A great example, of course, is that early Impressionists were considered radicals in their day, and their techniques and methods were roasted. The monetary value of work is also confusing and disorienting when discussing good and bad art. Just because a piece of artwork is expensive or has garnered the most amount of money at auction does not necessarily legitimize its worth. Remembering that whether art is good or bad is a personal judgment, and the monetary value of a piece of work is entirely contingent upon what someone is willing to pay for it. You may be willing to pay $100 for a painting that your daughter made, a finger painting that your daughter made, but it's completely valueless to another person. Neither of these perceptions about the worth of a piece help to inform whether that finger painting is intrinsically good or bad. Also, remembering that an artist inevitably produces work within thereof that is better or worse, therefore good or bad. Good artists don't always produce good art, and most artists readily admit their failures and successes. In a discussion actually at this museum last year, Nancy and Bob Magoon, CEO and director Heidi Zuckerman, discussed a 2015 exhibition of Bjork's work at MoMA. She said there had been wide consensus that this exhibit was unsuccessful or bad. I'm going to use those words interchangeably. Few would argue that Bjork creates good music and is a good artist. In fact, Peter Sheldahl, discerning critic for The New Yorker, writes, "All the critics, now including me, hasten to acknowledge her musical genius and personal charisma." However, many art critics concluded that this expression of her work was unsuccessful. And sure enough, Sheldahl continues, New York Magazine's Jerry Saltz adjudged the show a discombobulated mess. Jason Farrago in The Guardian called it a fiasco, and not to waffle, a disaster. A good artist making bad art. So what are the qualities or attributes that help to define what good art is, therefore conversely defining what bad art is in the absence of these properties? In no particular order, craftsmanship and/or technical skill, innovation, take Jackson Pollock or Duchamp, aesthetics, which include the composition of the work and maybe use of materials, concept, does the idea of the work go beyond a pretty picture, for instance, Robert Morris, and maybe most importantly, intent and communication or meaning. Did the artist successfully communicate the intention of the piece of artwork and allow a platform of communication with the viewer? Did it evoke an emotion or feeling? For example, Picasso's gruesome Guernica. There is no question that context inherently influences the way a piece of artwork is viewed. If you enter a museum or gallery, one makes the assumption that good art is being exhibited. Maybe this is an assumption we should all challenge. Would you appreciate a Monet painting as much if it were installed in the bathroom of a gas station? Does one appreciate a Diane Arbus photograph if it is viewed in a room of Thomas Kincaid paintings? Finally, arriving at the determination that there is such a thing as bad art recognizes the importance of bad art. Acknowledging that there is bad art helps us to be discriminating, to challenge ourselves to consider why we have come to this conclusion. Alas, it is our right to declare this is bad art, but it is our privilege and our challenge to be curious why this is our assertion, and hopefully we will be open.
Thank you, Lisa. Okay, we will now go to Therese.
Thank you.
Make your argument.
Okay. There is no such thing as bad art. I'd like to begin by discussing the criteria by which we judge art. We enlist the opinions of artists, art schools, curators, galleries, museums, art fairs, auction houses, art critics, art magazines, art historians, and the public to make determinations of value. Popularity, historical significance, monetary value, artistic trends, and the opinion of experts all express influence. Each comes from a position, both expert and non-expert, and each offers an opinion. What does that look like? Well, artists often base their opinion on their own education, their experience in the art world, and what kind of art they are interested in. Art schools offer their students instruction on how to make art, how to be an artist, and often discuss the seriousness of a particular work. Galleries show either what they can sell or what they think is important, sometimes both, we hope. Museums feature what they think is significant from our time or from the past. Art fairs offer current thinking and gallery trends alongside with some very exciting art spectacles. And art magazines have their very own intentionally obtuse language to discuss what they deem worthwhile. Art historians let us know what remains important from the past. And the public lets us know what people like outside of these institutions through discussions of public art and through the impressions that the general public have about the very institutions listed previously. Who is to do the validation? Is it by popularity, by what people like, by trend, by what ideas are currently held dear, by significance, what remains important, by monetary value, what auction and gallery sales reflect, by institutional embrace, what galleries, museums, and art fairs are showing, or even by visitor numbers, how many people come to see a show? These are all empirical measures, but these multiple measures use extremely different criteria to assess value. The use of significantly different criteria for the judging of value for art is problematic. It means that judging quality is a very tricky area, and there are only subjective opinions. It means that there can be no one voice to say that there is such a thing as good art. There have been attempts to find an objective way of making aesthetic judgments. Some have had brief impact, some have had lasting and occasional import, but none offer anything by way of an objective assessment. The Greeks used the golden ratio. And artists have used John Thomas Smith's occasionally useful The Rule of Thirds. The 17th century English painter William Hogarth had his line of beauty. Very interesting idea. In 1796, the president of the Royal Academy of Art was hoaxed terribly when a formula was uncovered that was supposedly used by Titian and other painters called the Venetian Secret. And I have a wonderful quote by the British artist Grayson Perry. He cheekily says, "I think I have found the 21st century version of with the Venetian Secret and its mathematical formula. What you do is you get a half-decent, non-offensive kind of idea. Then you times it by the number of studio assistants. And then you divide it with an ambitious art dealer. And that equals the number of oligarchs and hedge fund managers in the world." Love that quote. So outrageous. Confusing all this is a change in what is even considered to be art. So the 20th century brought us a change in what we were looking at. With conceptual, participatory, and social practice art, which contests the idea that there might even be something to look at, or something aesthetic to judge. Even in this museum, with so many people sitting right here in this room who make art, or who are educated about art, or who work with art, or who even simply have a great interest in art, there are none of us who could consistently agree what would constitute good art. That's all of you. So there is no absolute criteria for establishing what is bad art. Therefore, there can be no such thing as bad art.
You just heard Teresa Booth Brown from the Anderson Ranch Arts Center here on Curated, Aspen Public Radio's arts and culture program. This week, we're playing The Great Debate, which took place at the Aspen Art Museum last month. First, we'll hear from Colorado Mountain College's Rob Martin, then Adam Lerner with the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver.
As I started to look into this, I realized that a definition of bad art presumes there are kind of two sides of the coin, but they are on the same coin. That's an important thing. And I looked back at a book, I have it here in front of me, it's called Formless, A User's Guide. And in it, both Rosalind Krauss and Eva Lambois took a look at the ideas that were first put forward really by Georges Bataille. His writings on the abject, on the castaway, the discarded. The base definition of abject regards our body. We become disgusted with that which has been discarded or cast away. Hair, fingernails, semen, excrement. Things that we leave from us and become the other are something that engenders disgust. Georges Bataille and Rosalind Krauss and Evelyn Boy all sort of compare this to the art world, the organism of the art world, if you will. What is this art world how is the abject similar? It's that which disgusts us, that we consider bad when we look at it. It's discarded and should be a call to action to examine the reasons we desire to withdraw from a piece. It's not necessarily that bad art is bad and never can change, but rather we look at it at ourselves and say, I don't like that, it's bad. What can I do about that? As we start to look at this, we see that it can also be used by curators and gallerists to challenge the visitor, to engage them to more deeply question the value of this piece. This stands in stark contrast to just accepting something. We don't want to just look at it and say, I like that, or I hate that, but rather why, and delve into that about ourselves. One of the things that makes it really complex is, of course, that bad art is both communally and individually defined. And we don't all have to agree. In fact, as you said, we very rarely do. As we look at that, we realize that the experience of the consumer of the art and the person who is being consumed by the art sometimes is radically different, potentially, than the cultural definition. As a piece of this, Sartre said that quality is the whole of being unveiling itself within the limitation of the there is. How do we define quality when we look at art? It's how it manifests itself within that particular thing. Bad art, therefore, has another function in the gallery as a call to action, a thrown gauntlet challenging the viewer or consumer to question their own standards. Without bad art, without the cast off, we end up with just an accepted culture of homogeneity, an average. Who wants that? Imagine for a moment that the art world is body, this organism that grows and changes and pulsates. Here we get a better feel for the need for the excrement. We need that cast off. The value in the organism is simply waste. But in the art organism, it's to keep things fresh and new. The organism thrives on heterogeneity. Without the types of new art, good, bad, or average, common or uncommon or unique, if all becomes equal, if we have no bad art, entropy leads us to stasis. We lose contrast between art, and that contrast takes energy out of the system. Instead, we need good art, bad art, art of all different kinds to actually inject energy into that system so that our conversation is often new and exciting. In the conclusion of Formalist, Krauss writes, in the making of the average produces the ideal, it must also generate its own waste and that over the very field of the formerly heterogeneous. Bad art must exist to enforce the breadth and in fact the life of the art organism. However, it must be a mutable definition. It must change as the organism itself changes, always existing but never being the same. Bad art changes through time, as does good art. It exists through all those changes, though.
That was a very academic.
I don't know why.
Very academic arguments there. Okay, what is Adam Lerner gets the final word here for now. So go ahead and.
When I was invited to do this, I had this paranoid fantasy like, wait, why was I chosen for the bad art side? But I'm really, really happy to be speaking about this because actually it touches very deeply to like those things that I've been thinking about a lot as a curator. And I've been a curator for about 20 years, and I've used the phrase bad art actually a lot. But maybe I've used the phrase more like, oh, like that really sucks, or that's really bad, or something like that. You know what though, like to be honest, if I had to say, like really, really what I was actually thinking is like that something more like, if I were to be honest, that's not really my taste, right? I was more thinking, that's not really appropriate for this context. Maybe that, I might have said like, maybe that's not mature, or that's not fully resolved as art. I might be even thinking, it's not even that original. And those are all things that kind of I might have said that's bad because exactly as Rob said, I wanted to throw the gauntlet. I wanted to say, like, I'm so great. I'm so smart as a curator because I know these things that other people don't know. And it's actually, I gotta say, the fundamental question that was asked Teresa, or asked us very earlier, which is the question, who makes the judgment? Who makes the judgment? What is good, what is bad, right? Now, we heard from Lissa early on, there's great consensus about what is good art. Well, maybe not really, actually. I mean, like, yeah, there's great consensus, but they're a really, really, really rarefied group of people. Curators, critics, you know, sort of like the art world.
Yeah, we all agree that what's good, or most of us agree. I actually think that Picasso's analytic period sucks. But you know what, though? It's like, I would say that, you know what? It's not bad. It's like, I say that just to be provocative. I say that what really is interesting is that, like, we as critics and curators, like, we feel better by making those judgments. We like to sort of think of ourselves as above it all. But the fact is, it's fundamentally subjective. And it depends upon the context. We establish the rules in which we judge what we think to be good. And we think those rules are completely universal. So saying that work is unsuccessful is not, as Lissa suggests, the same thing as saying it's bad. Because saying it's unsuccessful just means it's unsuccessful in this context. It doesn't work. And the only really example you guys have heard of what might be bad art really is Bjork? Bjork really is our example of bad art? I mean, maybe that exhibition was unsuccessful and it felt bad, and we could say it's bad in the context of the museum, but really, actually, that stuff's pretty interesting. And maybe it doesn't fully resolve itself, but you know what? I gotta say, and I didn't love that exhibition either. And I kind of probably said it sucked. But the fact is, like, in another context, it would be really interesting. And I'm actually more interested often in art that doesn't fully realize itself, doesn't fully resolve itself in, like, this perfection. Because that tells me something more about the human behind it. Like, the kind of, when things fail a bit, that's actually when they're more interesting. And the habit of mind that we have to make judgments is just a habit of mind. We just like to feel ourselves superior by believing that we as curators have the superiority of judgment. I know this because it's happened to me over and over again. And even though I've helped collectors spend tens of thousands of dollars on works of art that I would say, like, this is a good one and this is a bad one, like, I also know that my taste is completely malleable. I know this because I curated an exhibition, a major exhibition, of this guy named Mark Mothersbaugh, an artist who was not even recognized within the field of art as an artist. He never had a museum exhibition, and I did his retrospective. And when I first saw his work, frankly, I didn't like it that much. It was like cartoonish, adolescent, it was scatological, to Rob's point. But you know what, though? I thought it was historically really important to show his point on the history of art. This is, by the way, the founder of the band Devo. Okay, so you might as well know him. Now, whip it good. Anyway, so after doing about 20 studio visits of this artist, I went to LA over and over again. I looked at tens of thousands, literally, of his drawings. He did like about 50 drawings a day. And I actually had this amazing experience, which is I felt literally my taste change. So here you have this narrative art, this cartoonish stuff that like, I know as a serious curator that that's not like what contemporary art is. Contemporary art is like conceptual, minimal, and it's like holds its, its cards close to its chest. But suddenly I found myself actually loving this stuff. And I love the fact that I felt my tastes change. I literally start to love it. And then I curated this exhibition that then traveled to 6 museums around the country because I was able to then experience like that transformation, able to help my audience see how something actually, how to get inside his world, how to see something as actually this as good, whereas in another context, it might not have appeared that way.
Thank you, Adam. That was good. Good thoughts up here. Lissa, I'd love to see a Monet in a gas station bathroom, and I expect Aspen to get right on it. I would like to note that there's some people who think there's bad art. I mean, there's a museum of bad art in Boston that Michelle's pointed out to me, and the founder is quoted as saying, "We are here to celebrate an artist's right to fail gloriously." So, and while there may be good and bad art, one of the beauties of art is that maybe it stimulates discussion and debate like we're having.
The audience posed a series of thoughtful and challenging questions to the panelists, but ultimately no consensus was reached on whether there is such a thing as bad art. In the typical Aspen fashion of agreeing yet disagreeing, the audience voted 47-47. Aspen Art Museum's president and CEO, Heidi Zuckerman, says the turnout of the event more than exceeded her expectations. So be on the lookout for more events like this from the Aspen Art Museum in the future. Jeremy Mone is a jazz and swing artist based in Boulder. Here's a new track off his most recent EP, Burning in Me. This song is called Boulder Health Food Boogie. He'll be playing tracks like this at the Temporary Friday night. Thank you.
and Boulder, who's got food on his mind. But killing baby spinach is about all they can find. He asked them for some fries, but rice was all that they had. They said they had some quinoa, it drove them clear mad. Fry him up a burger or a leg and a thigh. Give him one more whiff of wheatgrass and I know that he'll die.
That was Boulder Health Food Boogie from Boulder-based swing artist Jeremy Mone. He'll be performing at the Temporary in Basalt this Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. For more information, visit tekaw.org. Here's what else is happening this week in the Valley. Tuesday through Friday, the Wheeler Opera House will be hosting a series of events in commemoration of John Denver. For the complete schedule, visit wheeleroperahouse.com. Thursday at the Launchpad, Carbondale Arts presents the two-person exhibition, Line of Totality. That opening reception begins at 6 o'clock p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, Thunder River Theater Company presents the last weekend of its production, Dead Man's Cell Phone, at 7:30 p.m. with a post-show conversation with the cast and director following Thursday's performance. Friday at the Art Base in Basalt, the exhibit Chromosphere from Aspen artist and landscape architect Lisa Kaplan opens, with the kickoff reception beginning at 5 o'clock p.m. in the Charles J. Wiley Gallery. Friday and Saturday, the Glenwood Vaudeville Review presents the production of its fall musical Little Shop of Horrors. Each showing begins at 7:30 p.m.
That's all that's curated this week. For more on arts and culture, tune in for Morning Edition weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. and visit us online at aspenpublicradio.org, where all episodes of this show live. I produced today's show solo. It was edited by Carolyn Zachariasen. Local musicians Greg Lout and Jason Patton wrote the show's theme tune, Omnicord Entrance. Special thanks to the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, which aims to support the arts, community, and outreach. Continue to follow Curated APR on Facebook for news and updates on arts in the Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Thank you so much for listening. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.